All right, welcome back to the Spirit Sirens podcast. I am Megan Campbell, your host, and today I'm going to be talking about Beef Eater. Specifically, I'll be trying Beef Eater 24 on account of that's the one that I have, but we're going to be talking about the Beef Eater brand in general. This one's a little bit different because the last two I've been talking about smaller brands, things that they would do to sort of grow themselves or to act more like a big brand. And today we're talking about a really big brand. Beef Eater is number three, roughly. I'm not sure what their current standing is, but they were number three in the world's premium best-selling gin. So it's pretty freaking big. So the first thing I'm going to do today is I'm going to talk about the bottle. Now, I've got the Beef Eater 24 bottle right in front of me, but I'll go ahead and talk about their regular bottle as well. Go ahead and log into their website here. Now, just real quick, whenever you log into a website for something that requires you to be over 21, some websites are going to be like, yes, no, all right, cool, we've done our due diligence, and some websites are going to ask for your full birth date. Now, as a person who's on a lot of websites for alcohol, it's irritating. I'd rather just hit the yes, no button and move on with my life, but from the other side, it's actually really nice when people put their real birthdays in there, so that way Beef Eater knows exactly who their demographic is, who's logging in and looking at their website. That's something that you really don't get, like, unless someone accesses Facebook from your website or whatever. You're looking for that consumer data. So every time I log in, they go, oh shit, 26-year-olds are interested in Beef Eater. That's really good. That's what we're trying to accomplish. Or, you know, if you're older, they go, okay, so we've got a 65-year-old logging into Beef Eater. Like, how can we further their experience here on our website? So the original bottle, the original Beef Eater bottle, I believe they're pretty much all going to be the same shape. It's a square bottle, which is a little bit different. It's more popular now, but when Beef Eater originally came out, square bottles were not popular at all. It was more expensive. It stood out on the shelf quite a bit, having that square bottle. Once again, it's got this real thick base, something to add extra weight to it. You're going to hear me talk about that a lot. There's very few companies that are going to make the mistake of having a light, delicate bottle, something that's got no heft at all to it, especially the bigger companies. They've got, you know, they've paid for consumer reports. They've paid for psychological, like, tests and stuff to see what people really like, what people want to see. You know, do you like this bottle versus that bottle? They paid for that stuff. So they're always going to make the right choice. And the right choice is pretty much always heavier bottle, thick base. So the original Beef Eater label, it's got that thick base. It's got that square shape. And then it's got their classic little guy on the front, the guy in the red with the little stick. Apparently, that is a certain type of guard in London called a Beef Eater, hence the name. Supposedly, if you live in London, you already know that that's a very recognizable symbol, especially when it first started, when the brand first came about. A very recognizable symbol, and that helped it a lot in its early years. So that's the Beef Eater regular bottle. Now the Beef Eater 24, which is what I'm mostly going to be talking about today, is their new bottle, and you can really see the difference in what they're trying to accomplish. So the Beef Eater 24 bottle, it's the same square shape. They're keeping that shape. It's a clearly different bottle. They've got a small, maybe 1.5 inch by 1.5 inch, the actual label with the Beef Eater 24 on it. The rest of the bottle is pressed glass, sort of this curling floral motif. A little bit subtle, but it definitely stands out at you. It sort of causes that refraction with the liquid inside the bottle, and it definitely jumps out at you on the shelf. The base, that thick base on the inside, they painted it red to give it a little bit more color at the bottom. And then the cap and the top area in general, the whole neck of it, has a red and black sort of alternating thin lines design going on. And it looks, actually, if I look really closely, there is a name on there as well. Someone's signature, James something. That's probably their head distiller. He's a bit of a celebrity distiller, but I'll get to that in a little while. You know, I think that's one of the nice things, one of the great things about being the distiller is you want to put your name on it somewhere. You can put your name on it somewhere. Okay, that looks like James something, but the name of the head distiller is Desmond Payne, which sounds like a character in Assassin's Creed. Maybe that's the original guy. Back of the label, they've got the Beef Eater London. They've got a short description of why it was inspired by and what's in it. and the resulting, and it's so good, and you love it. Signed by Desmond Payne, the master distiller. They've got this little silhouette of the London skyline, probably not the real skyline, just a bunch of their notable landmarks sort of shoved next to each other over the Surgeon General's warning. And then there's a little crow with a key down in the bottom, and that's super cute. Actually, if you look through the front of the bottle, you can still see the distinct silhouettes in the background. I hadn't noticed that before. If you have this at eye level, it's very easy to see those silhouettes through the bottle. Doesn't take away from the front of it or anything. So here again, what they've done is they've got a smaller label, so they needed to break it up, hence the red on the bottom, the red and the black on the top, and you don't even notice the, like, 3 inches of absolutely nothing on the front because it's got this pressed glass shape into it. It's not nothing, it's just not a bunch of color. Now, if you go to their website, which I've linked in the comments, if you go to their website, there is a huge difference between their Beefeater original gin page and their Beefeater 24 page. So their original page, it's red and white, very clear. It's got like a chevron motif in the back. That's part of their new advertising campaign, is the red and white chevron. And it looks like it's got a link or a video showing off their new campaign. And then it's got Beefeater, tonic, lemon, orange. It's how we do it in London. The definitive B and T. And then they've got a picture of the drink with someone with sick tattoos holding the drink up. There's a lot going on here. So first of all, you see someone with these cool tattoos holding sort of a large wine glass with this gin and tonic in it. That tells you a lot about who Beefeater is trying to capture right now. Like, they are absolutely hitting hard going at my age range. They want those 30-somethings and down to absolutely not any younger than 21. We would never advertise to people younger than 21. Don't be ridiculous. So they're going for that younger demographic. They want to make gin cool again. They want to redefine what it means. So right off the bat, you see Beefeater, tonic, and then lemon and orange is what they recommend their gin with, which is kind of cool. Most people, they go tonic and lime, whatever. They don't even think about it. That's part of the new gin movement, is sort of redefining what goes with your gin. Your gin doesn't make every single classic gin drink there is. It's your own. It's something unique. It's not the standard gin. And for a long time, people have really considered Beefeater to be the standard gin or one of the standard gins. And they're trying to go, no, it's not. Even our classic Beefeater is something different from the rest. It's got to be paired with lemon and orange. That's what makes it great. That's the best way to have it. And you need to think a little bit more about our product when you order it. That's how we do it in London, the definitive B&T. I really like that. That's a great way to sort of tagline your product. You want to take something that people know and people already use, the G&T, the gin and tonic. That's already part of the standard cocktail nomenclature. Not that I think anyone actually orders it that way. I've seen it on a couple of menus that way, but nobody actually like, oh, I'll have a G&T. I'm like, no, it's not that hard to say gin, and then I'm going to ask you what your gin preference is anyways, so you might as well just lead with that and save us all a little bit of trouble. But when they redefine it like this, the definitive B&T, that's something that their salespeople can play up, like, you should order this, you should say it like this. And it's also something customers can go, okay, well, next time I go in, I know I'm looking for a B&T. And then I can say that to the bartender, and they're not only going to give me the Beefeater that I want, they're also going to give me the lemon and orange in it, because they're a well-trained bartender that knows what I'm asking for, and they've listened to this campaign. So you keep scrolling down. They've got a couple of cocktails, gorgeous pictures. I really, really love them. They've got like this. They've got this sort of marbled-looking concrete that they've got the glasses sitting on, and behind them is a brick wall. There's just a little bit of light shining through, sort of like a spotlight thing going on. Really draws your attention to the glasses and the colors while still having an interesting background. It gives you something to break it up. Really gorgeous pictures. I love taking cocktail pictures. I love taking drink pictures. And they've done a spectacular job with this, as they should, because somebody is getting paid good money for it, right? They've got the White Lady, that's a classic cocktail. The Negroni, that's a classic cocktail. And then they've got Martini Kaya, a little bit different. Let's see what's in that one. Beefeater Gin, 4 parts, Dolin de Chambray, and Vermouth. Okay, so that looks sort of like a twist on a classic martini. And Sage Against the Machine, your Beefeater, your apple juice, your lemon juice, your sugar syrup, and some salt. Nice, that sounds pretty tasty. I'd go for it. And then down at the bottom, they've got a list of their botanicals. Now, some companies will keep their botanicals a secret. They go, well, this is proprietary. We don't want you to know. You know, the secret ingredient is actually, like, cucumber. No, that one's normal. The secret ingredient is something weird, like red pepper flakes, right? And they don't want you to know. That's what makes it different. That's what makes it special. That's what makes it great. But big companies like Beefeater and Tanqueray is especially well known for this. They don't care. They'll tell you what's in it. There's some standard ones. So obviously you have to have juniper. You usually have coriander. You usually have orris and licorice and angelica and some kind of citrus. They don't care. They're going to tell you what's in it because, one, the real difference in a high-quality gin is how much you use. So if you put too much of one thing, it's going to completely change the flavor. It's all about the delicate balance that you try to maintain with your gin. You want to have that juniper come through, but you want to have a strong backbone of other flavors. You want to have that citrus come through, but you don't want it to overwhelm the rest of your profile. So the real hidden quality to it is in how much of everything you use. The other thing is the quality. I mean, Beefeater has the resources and the money to go out there and buy the best damn licorice root that they can get their hands on. They've got the best juniper, the best lemon, the best coriander, and they're going to do more with it than I can do in my dinky little garage, right? They're going to be able to source the best of the best, and then whatever's left over is what actually gets sold. So they don't really need to keep that a secret. They can tell you till they're blue in the face exactly what they do, but you're never going to be able to replicate theirs unless you have their proprietary blend and unless you have the best possible ingredients. And part of it comes down to they just honestly don't care. Because if Lucidi Distilling comes out with a gin that tastes exactly like Beefeater, right? We've nailed it. We've got their secret recipe. We've got the best resources. We managed to make it taste just like Beefeater 24. Well, first of all, I can never give you that for the same price as Beefeater, because it's a small company. Second of all, you already have Beefeater. Why would you want somebody else's product that's exactly the way the original is? Nobody wants that. You've got to build. You've got to do better. You've got to do different. Otherwise, nobody's going to care who you are or what you make. And thirdly, is the whole reason that I started this podcast is because it's not just about what's in the bottle. Beefeater has hundreds of years of history. They have these gorgeous bottles. They've got these huge advertising campaigns, and they've got all this money to make sure that you know that Beefeater is the best damn gin you've ever had. So even if you managed to completely replicate their recipe, everything was perfect, and somehow you were able to give it to people at the same price as Beefeater, it doesn't even matter. You still will never even be a blip on their radar. So when people go on about these secret recipes or these family recipes or stuff like that, it's more of a talking point. It's more of a cool customer perspective thing, you know? Like, if I can make the exact same spices as KFC and make this great chicken, it doesn't mean I'm the next KFC. It means that I can make it at home and not pay for KFC. People aren't going to come from all around, oh my god, you figured out KFC's secret recipe. Like, no, nobody cares. It doesn't matter. We've already got that. So the whole secret recipe thing, that's a lot more for the consumer benefit than it is strictly because they have to keep it a secret or they're going to miss on something by not keeping it a secret. So what makes Beefeater 24 a little bit different? So I talked about, you go to their page, it's this bright white, it's got this red chevron look, very clean, very crisp, you know who they're advertising to. You go to the Beefeater 24 page, and it's the exact opposite. It's dark, they've got this bright red lighting. The Beefeater 24 bottle, they're actually shining it in a red light, so it looks like the entire bottle is red. And they've got this gorgeous cocktail next to it. They start out a sophisticated blend of fine botanicals and exotic teas. They've got this woman, she's sort of half lit, this red lighting, the lots of dark, lots of shadows. She's sipping on a cocktail. They're trying to tell you, this is completely different. This isn't a summer day. This is sophistication. This is class. This is a night on the town. This is the kind of thing that you drink when you want to impress your date or you want to impress your boss. The company line on the Beefeater 24, they say, Beefeater 24 is our master distiller's contribution to the Beefeater legacy. Made in the heart of London from 12 hand-selected botanicals, including Japanese sencha and Chinese green teas, it is a sophisticated and modern London dry gin, designed to inspire mixologists around the world. The inspiration for Beefeater 24 came when our master distiller, Desmond Payne, MBE, was traveling in the Far East. Quinine is banned in Japan. That's interesting. I should look that up. Quinine is banned in Japan, resulting in tonics that are comparatively sweet. As an alternative, Desmond chose to mix his Beefeater gin with chilled green tea. The resulting gin and tea combination was remarkable and inspired Desmond to spend the next 18 months experimenting with different teas and botanical blends. The result is an exceptionally mixable gin with a unique aromatic profile and superior smoothness ideal for contemporary cocktails. So, this is a fun story. It's a cute story. And it might even be a real story. Now, one of the things that people, that humans love is that light bulb moment. You know, they love the eureka moment. Like, oh, he was in his tub and the idea came to him and he jumped out naked and running around and shouting eureka. Like, people love that. So when you create a story, when you create a new product, you want to create a story to go with it, right? So they say Desmond Payne was in Japan and he had this eureka moment. Oh my God, gin and tea. It's all so simple. But gin and tea has been a drink for forever. It's not new. It's not unusual. Anywhere you've had a liquor and something that's not a liquor, people have tried putting it together. Now, that's not to say he didn't have this cool moment where he was like, oh man, this tastes delicious. I wonder how I can, you know, put that flavor into the bottle without compromising the original spirit. Yeah, maybe he had that moment, but I think it's a little bit more likely that he knew that gin and tea were an excellent combination, that the cocktail world and the craft gin movement were creating change, that people were looking for new botanicals and they were looking for new flavors and they wanted something that goes great in cocktails. And he just knew that tea was a great combination. Maybe that's something he was already drinking at home. Maybe that's something he walked into a bar and saw, oh, gin and tea together. Oh yeah, okay, that's a great idea. We should do that. One of the things you do as a distillery, as any company that's creating a product, is you create these stories to go with it. These things that people can latch onto and tell these bar stories, right? This is exactly the kind of thing that you sit down at a bar, you order your Beefeater 24, and the person next to you makes some kind of comment, and you can come out the door like, oh yeah, the inspiration came from whatever. Or you're on a date, you order this, it's a nice icebreaker. Like, it's an icebreaker story, which is great for them. They've created this as something to talk about, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's what really happened. I mean, for all we know, he was in Japan sourcing materials because he knew he already wanted to do this. And you continue to scroll down, the motif continues, very dark, very moody, very modernistic look. The cocktails, they've got a spritz, they've got a gin and tonic, they've got a bramble, they've got a Collins, they've got a French 24, and then the Zesty Bell, which I think is probably one of my favorite names I've ever seen on a drink. So out of the six cocktails they've listed here, only one of them seems to be, only one of them is more of an original new cocktail just for this. So that's their two main ones. I'll talk about one other spirit that they're doing in just a little bit, but I want to talk about the Beefeater brand in general, what they're doing, where they came from, and why they made the choices that they made. So most of the spirits I'm going to be talking about are a little bit newer. They're trying to make it on the market. They're not these big name brands. One of the cool things about Beefeater is not only are they a big name brand, but they do have real history. Something that a lot of spirits companies do, a lot of companies in general, I think, is they try to find whatever the oldest point in history is that they can reasonably say they come from, and they run with it. For example, at the fire station, we always led with, this building has been here since 1920. Okay, that's super cool. People are super into that. Oh, wow, I'm standing in an old building like that. For those of you not in the United States, 1920 was like a while ago for us. Something built back then does count as old for us. I know that doesn't count in London or in Egypt or whatever, that's not an old building, but here it is. So we always start with, well, this building was built in 1920, and then this came along, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and then we opened 2 years ago. But people don't really listen to that part. They listen to the parts about how old it is. They feel like they're experiencing history. They feel like you've created that connection in their mind to roots. So with that said, Beefeater, the brand, comes out the door swinging at trace our roots to 1820. Like, okay, that was a hot minute ago. All right, let's talk about it. So they trace their roots to 1820. That was when the first factory was opened, except for that first factory was opened, they didn't own it, and the founder of the company wasn't even born until 1835. So to me, go, okay, well, that's not your roots. Like, that's just a factory opening that you happen to buy later. Like, okay, 1835, a founder is born. Okay. Like, I personally don't really go, okay, well, when does your story start? Like, oh, when did you start in sales? Well, I was born in 1992. Like, what? No, that's not what I asked. I asked when you started in sales, when you started in the liquor industry. When you were born doesn't matter. I don't care when you were born. That's not when this all started. So personally, I think they're reaching a little far back. And then 1863, I've actually got it in here, is 1963. He waited 130 years to start distilling. Nope. Okay, so 1835, the founder is born. 1863 is when he actually buys that distillery and starts distilling. And then somewhere between 76 and 1908 is when Beefeater actually started being produced. So some places you're going to see the 1863 is when they started. That was when he started. He took over the factory. He continued to make their liqueurs, some original products, just kept that going. And then between 1876 and 1908 is when the actual Beefeater brand was born. So I can see why they would do this, right? So you've got a choice when you're advertising your company. You can either say 1900 is when Beefeater was born, or you can say 1820. Like, well, 1820 sounds a lot further, honestly. Like, just that animal part of your brain that doesn't want to do math, that doesn't want to think about stuff. You say 1820 versus 1900, it produces a little bit of a different reaction in people. So that's one of the things that a lot of companies do, is they try to reach as far back as possible and run with it. Now, this is especially true when it's not actually family owned anymore, right? So the original founder owned it. He passed it on to his kids, passed it on to their kids. Their kids sold it to some other guy eventually sold it in 2005 to Pernod Ricard Company. If you don't know who they are, it's a liquor company. They also own Chivas, Absolut, Jameson, Malibu, Seagram's, and Kahlua, along with probably 15 other spirits and a couple of wines. So they are a large company. They own the number 3 selling gin, at the very least. They own Absolut, which is consistently in the top 5 vodkas. They own Jameson, consistently in the top 5 whiskeys that are being sold. So it's a big company. And once you get a big company like that, you especially don't want to make a big deal out of it, right? If you live in Arizona, you've heard of Four Peaks Beers. They were one of the original small breweries in Arizona. They sold probably 4 years ago. They sold to Budweiser, Anheuser-Busch Company. And a lot of people have gone, oh, I know that that's not made by a local company anymore. It's not owned by a local company anymore. I don't want that. It doesn't matter that it's made in the same place. It doesn't matter that it's made by the same people, but it's owned by a larger company and they're done with it. So that's the kind of thing you really want to avoid with a buyout like that, is people even knowing that it happened. People in the industry go, oh, cool, Pernod Ricard bought Beefeater. Now it's going to be a little bit easier. It's going to be a little bit more consistent getting the product. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be bundled with other spirits. I can buy it in batches like that. And they're going to have a certain amount of advertising behind it that I can rely on, right? They're going to be the ones out there with little flags, or they're going to be the ones that are sponsoring the menus. So you'll see out of their 10 cocktails that are listed on the page, 5 of them are going to be made with this spirit, right? That's the kind of company you're talking about with Pernod. So just to reiterate, when a larger company like that buys it, that's when you're really going to see them double down on their historical roots. They don't want you to think about right now. They want you to think about the roots. Now, Beefeater 24 was launched in 2008. That's pretty much right at the beginning of the real cocktail revolution, when things started reaching sort of the mainstream. You didn't have to be a bartender. You didn't have to be an enthusiast in order to see the changes that were going on. I would say it was right around 2008 was when that started to happen. They launched Beefeater 24 specifically in response to that going on, that people were starting to demand more unusual gins, more high-quality gins, and they wanted to be using gins in cocktails, in stuff that was above and beyond. So I think in that respect, Beefeater has been definitely ahead of the game. They've been very responsive to the market. There are a lot of larger companies that are really only just now catching on to this sort of quality revolution. I think there's a lot of companies that are just now going, wait a second, we need to make spirits that are good for cocktails. We need to be a part of this. We need to be a part of the culture and not just creating a liquor. So they launched Beefeater 24 in 2008. That was definitely their biggest launch. This is their addition to the Beefeater line, the permanent edition, the sort of, I would call it like the brother bottle, right? This is a brother and a sister bottle. They're definitely staying together. They're on the shelf next to each other. They're not seasonal. They're not temporary. They're here. Some of the other things that they have listed on their website, the Beefeater Pink Gin, a strawberry flavored gin based on the original recipe. Personally, I really like that. I think that's a great way for them to make gin a little bit more accessible. It does lean more towards advertising towards women. It's an unfortunate truth that a lot of men, when they see a pink bottle, they're just going to outright dismiss it, right? Their eyes just glaze right over it. But eyes are glazing over a lot of stuff when people are in a liquor store. You have to ask yourself, am I willing to give up that male gaze in order to capture a larger female audience? And usually the answer is yes. Partially because women are just as much purchasers of liquor. And you know, if you have a pink gin, people are going to go, oh, wow, okay, I really want that. Oh, it's a strawberry gin. I really want that. I want to try that. And partially because you're not always giving up the male gaze. Maybe the guy is there buying something. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been gifted a bottle from a guy that was pink or sparkly or purple or whatever, because they go, oh, this is what women like. Let's bring this. As a sort of aside, that was not a good Valentine's Day. The guy knew I was a bartender, and he knew I liked high-quality spirits, and he brought me a sparkling purple Moscato, and it tasted like a sparkling purple Moscato. Once we finally actually got around to opening it and trying it, I was wildly underwhelmed, and I didn't even know it was a date. Okay, so they released the Beefeater Pink Gin. I personally have never seen that. It might be just a UK product, and it could just be I wasn't looking. Now, I want to sort of reverse a little bit, talk about what made Beefeater originally a good company. Why were they originally successful? And it pretty much comes down to they were ready and willing to export when the rest of the world wasn't. So if you know anything about your history, you might know that English people have a tendency to go everywhere. They've got a tendency to want their original stuff when they go everywhere. And Beefeater was pretty much the only London gin that was poised to create that. They also were really playing up their London-ness, right? They were a true London-based London gin company, the flavor of home, and you can have it right here in Africa or South America or North America or wherever you happen to be planting your flag at that particular moment. So they were very English focused. They had the Beefeater guy on the front. They had the Beefeater name. They had that taste of home quality to it. And there's definitely something to be said for being the only option. One of the things that we sell at my company, we've got these beers out of Thailand. This is one, it's their major brand. It's one beer, but it's in every single Thai restaurant in Arizona because it's the Thai beer. It's the only one that's available. It's an easy sell for them. They go, oh, if you want the taste of Thailand, you drink this beer. And that's exactly what they were doing. They were going, if you want the taste of London, you drink Beefeater gin. There is no alternative. If you even manage to get your hands on some other gin, it's either local and it's not the flavor you're looking for. And quite frankly, historically speaking, English were not very nice about local spirits. Or it's the old school, the Geneva, it's the Dutch gin, the Holland gin, which wasn't the same at all. That's not what you were looking for. If you wanted a London dry gin and someone said, well, I've got this Holland gin, like, no, that's not what I asked for. It's nothing like what I asked for. They both technically have juniper, so I guess thanks for that. Another thing that I think they've done very well at is automating to keep small. According to, and I've got the link in the comments, according to one post that I read, there's only 10 employees working at the actual factory, which when I first thought of it, I thought that's insane. That's crazy. There's only 10 employees. But upon reflecting a little bit further, you know what? That's not insane. With the technology we have nowadays, everything is monitored, right? Even a small distillery, you can have for, you know, $10,000, you can have instruments installed that everything is monitored and it goes directly to your phone. You could go, oh, brewing temperatures look good, distilling temperatures look good, it's going to start distillation process in 20 minutes, it'll run for 8 hours, whatever. So you can see it all from a phone or a tablet. It makes it incredibly easy as the distiller. So you say, maybe we know you've got the head distiller there, got two guys who are essentially babysitting distillers. They're, you know, like what I used to do, like, okay, you know the process, this is what I want done, here you go, do it. And then you've got someone watching the bottling line. If they do 24 hours, you've got, you know, three people watching the bottling line. They take turns. And then you've got people loading trucks, boxing it up, and sending it on its way. That's actually pretty reasonable that they can, with 10 employees, provide enough liquor for the entire world to be the third best-selling premium gin in the entire world. Part of that is also because they no longer have sort of the executive problems that they need to deal with at the Beefeater branch, right? They've got the advertising through Pernod. They've got the sales through Pernod. They've got other people out there representing, making those decisions so that they can focus on just making the liquor, which I think is really the dream. I think they've nailed it as far as they can continue to create new specialty spirits. They can engage with the customers. They can engage with their fans without having to worry about sort of the day-to-day, kind of the crappy side of the industry. They've sold that job to somebody else. Now, one more thing. Not really, one more thing. I say that a lot. That's not the truth. I'm going to just keep talking. Beefeater has done a fantastic job of integrating with the cocktail community. So the reason I even have this bottle of Beefeater 24 is because of the Mix London competition. So I think one of the most brilliant things you can do as a spirits company is to have a cocktail competition, especially once you get larger, right? So this doesn't come out of your regular budget, you're making a space for this. This is your advertising budget. When you consider how much a TV spot costs on a decent primetime show, or you consider how much a billboard costs, or how much your YouTube spots cost, when you take the price of those, and as a large company like Beefeater, you're going to be spending a lot. You've got a pretty freaking big advertising budget. And you go, okay, well, for the same price, could I host some small local competitions, right? Which is not that expensive. Basically, it's the cost of like a case of liquor plus a judge for a few hours. If you don't have volunteers. And then how much does it cost to ship like 12 people to London for the big event? Okay, you're a big company. You do that pretty often. Not bad. And then the time of the people who make the spirit. So, which you have control over. You're their boss. You're the company that owns it. You've got their time. That's not expensive to you. So the Mix London competition, I think maybe you're not supposed to just open up this page and let it sit for a while, because this dude looks weird as shit right now. The one that's looking at me, he's got like sort of this silly look on his face. He's biting his winning trophy thing. He's like half biting it. It's weird looking. I think you're supposed to scroll down pretty much immediately. Oh yeah, the next girl, she looks much classier. She's not biting anything. I think is a good look. When someone's taking a picture, try not to bite stuff. That's just a little life pro tip right there. So the Mix London competition, they sent it out. They said, okay, get the drink. Now, theoretically, if you were a bartender, you would use the one at work and nobody would ask any questions, because that's what you do. You experiment with new cocktails when you're working. As long as you're not using like the entire bottle, nobody cares. So you would use the one at work. You would come up with your cocktail and you would start using the Beefeater 24 bottle. You go, hey, regular customer, hey, John, I'm trying out for this competition. I'm making this new cocktail. Do you want to try it? You know, I'll do it. Our special today is like $7. I'll charge you for the special today. And John goes, oh yeah, that sounds awesome. I'll do it. I'll try it. And he tries it and he pays for it. And then he tells his friend, he's like, oh yeah, you know, Megan back behind the bar is trying this new cocktail. You should totally check it out. Or he takes a picture and he puts it online and he tags you in it. And he tags Beefeater in it. And you have now become free advertising. Not only that, your bar has paid for that advertising, because that Beefeater that you just used, they're going to have to replace, especially if you're doing that with 8 or 9 of your regular customers, or if you make that your special, right? If you've got that power at work to decide what your specials are, you go, okay, well, here's this one. It's for the Beefeater competition. Check it out. Tag me in it. Tag your pictures in it. Tag your friends in it. Come try it. It's going to help me. It's going to help the bar. And then Beefeater is getting all of this sincere organic growth this organic discussion just because one bartender wants to compete in this competition. Now, you multiply that by however many people in your city are trying, and then however many people in your country are trying, and this is telling me 31 countries faced off in this competition. 31 countries, bartenders from all of those countries tried to get into this competition. That's incredible, right? And for what cost? They didn't pay me to do that. They didn't pay me to go get this bottle or to talk to my friends and family about it or to tag it on my Instagram and my Facebook and my Twitter. They didn't pay for any of that. I paid for that. I bought the bottle. That's just incredible. That's, in my opinion, that is literally the best thing you can do as a spirits company, is to create a competition like that that people are genuinely excited to get into. And it doesn't even have to be that big, you know? Like Lucidi's, they're a long ways from 31 countries trying to participate or us being able to afford anything like that. But if you were to create a cocktail competition here in Phoenix, you could get 20 bartenders from 20 of the top bars in Arizona. That would be a huge deal for a small company like us to have that kind of organic traction, to have people trying our spirits and talking about our spirits, and to have those high quality bartenders engaging with our spirits. It's gonna make a huge difference. The thing that I also particularly liked about the Beefeater competition was the idea was that they wanted you to represent where you come from. They didn't want just a great cocktail. You also, when you create a competition like this, you have to have a theme. It can't just be, shit, yeah, this is delicious. That's not a theme. So the theme of the Beefeater competition was representing the unique terrier, the unique flavor of the place that you come from. Now, to me, that was really exciting. I love Arizona. I love Phoenix. I think there are flavors and smells and experiences that are very unique to Arizona. There's something, you know, the smell of rain, the smell when it's wet outside or right before rain or right after rain. That is part of who we are. That's something that when somebody leaves Arizona, you know, anytime you have someone who's born and raised in Arizona and they go somewhere else and it starts to rain, you can see the disappointment on their face when the rain starts coming down and the smell doesn't change. Like, it's you can see the disappointment on their face because there's a certain quality when it rains here that you don't get anywhere else. And that was what I wanted to capture. That was, you know, it's been a year and a half and I'm still thinking about that drink. I'm still thinking about this competition. That made a difference. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, I'm not the only one that's passionate about Arizona, and people are passionate about where they come from. You know, maybe there's some guy in Oregon who was like, you know, we have the best blackberries in the whole world, and I've got to showcase those. I've got to show those off in the Beefeater 24 competition. I use that in particular because my father will not shut up about how great the blackberries in Oregon were and how I need to try them, and I haven't eaten a blackberry until I've eaten a blackberry from Oregon. So if you're from California or apparently Eastern Europe also has spectacular blackberries, and you say, oh my god, Oregon's are inferior to mine in every way, then that's exactly what I'm talking about right now. You are passionate about where you come from. There are flavors of where you come from that you talk about, that you want to get out there to the world. And Beefeater really hit the nail on the head. They really capitalized on how passionate we all are about where we live. They mixed that into how passionate they are about London. They gave you this feeling. They tied your love of where you are to their product and their love of where they are. It's one of the things that they are very sincere about, is they go, we're from London. We are the only London dry gin that's still produced in London. And that's a really big deal to them. They've engaged with the cocktail community in a way that's very sincere, in a way that really impacts you emotionally, in a way that you can get passionate about. And that is just good advertising. You know, a billboard is never going to make me feel the way that cocktail made me feel. I'm never going to think about it as much as I thought about that drink. And that's one of the great things about being a liquor company is, you know, you can't do that with a car company. It's not as feasible, right? Okay, so you're Ford and you want to have a competition, who can modify your car the coolest. Like, okay, that's cool. That's great. But that's really expensive. Very few people are going to be able to actually participate and actually engage. And then the number of people that they talk to it about that are going to be just as interested, who go, oh, wow, I want to help with that. I want to try and engage with you in that competition. It's very limiting. That's one of the great things about a cocktail competition is it's so social. It's not just the person making it. It's not just the judge. It's the rest of the people who can come together and go, oh, I loved this one. I loved that one. John from Undertow was able to do this drink with it. And I thought that really expressed where we're from. You can't create this kind of social atmosphere nearly as easily with any other brand. Okay, so I think I've talked as much as I probably can about Beefeater, the company, the brand. So now it's time to actually drink the Beefeater gin. For the record, the drink that I made had green bell pepper juice and lemon and the gin, obviously. I did a maceration of creosote in high-proof alcohol, and then I spritzed it over the top so you get sort of that, when you bring the drink up to your face, you get that flavor or that smell of rain. Now, it turns out that, this is something I looked up after I did it and submitted it, it turns out that creosote is not on the FDA safe list because in high enough quantities, it can cause severe liver damage, which I thought was a little bit ironic. I feel like I should get maybe an exception on account of I'm not using high enough quantities, and if you actually drank enough of this liquor to get severe liver damage from the creosote, then you'd probably already have ruined your liver from all of the alcohol, which, I don't know, I guess the FDA probably doesn't go, well, you're already fucked, so why not a little bit more? That's not their policy on food, which I think is very interesting, because it's unexpected. On the nose, you definitely get the juniper and the citrus right up front. First sip, you've got a lot of citrus there as well. I think I get a little bit of a hit of that green tea right on the front end, and then it sort of falls away into the juniper. Pretty much no burn at all. This is actually remarkably smooth. It's 45% alcohol, 45% ABV, and it's like 11 o'clock right now. So it's not like I've been drinking and dulled my taste buds. Like I haven't drank in like 3 days, and there's no burn at all with this. Definitely a lot of citrus, a lot of juniper. I think that sort of bitterness on the sort of the back sides of my tongue, pretty sure that's the green tea. You know, I don't remember what do they say you put in a gin and tonic with this one? Let's see. Let's check it out. Beefeater 24 gin and tonic. Beefeater, tonic, and ice. And they actually don't recommend any fruits on the little description. In the picture, though, they have a grapefruit and a blackberry. I hate grapefruit, so that wouldn't happen, but I think sort of the tartness and the sweetness from a blackberry would definitely do some good things right here. Yeah, I still like it. I liked it when I bought it. I think I definitely like it better than the original Beefeater, but it has been a while since I had that straight, but I definitely recommend the 24. I think it's incredibly smooth. If you're a gin person at all, I think it mixes very well. It was designed to be great in classic cocktails or in your new invention cocktails. But this is a great gin. They did an incredible job on it. Overall, I love the bottle. I think it's very, very elegant. I think it jumps out to me. I love the sort of floral design on it with the labels, but I think it's not too feminine. I think it's still something a guy would reach out and get and try without feeling uncomfortable or like he was going to get made fun of or something like that. I think the red and black on the top really seal the deal with it not being just for women. Oh, and one more thing that they're doing right. So they're not only did they release the Beefeater 24 as sort of a response to the cocktail revolution, they've also looked at the whiskey revolution, the way that people are seeking out these high-end, super expensive whiskeys, and they go, well, how can we tap into that market? And in response, they put out the Beefeater Burroughs Reserve Edition. They did one, now they're on to two. It's in this sort of rounded bottle with this floral design on the front. Definitely reminiscent of the Cognacs and the Armagnacs. It's the same shape. It's barrel-rested oak-rested gin, which is really in right now because everyone's trying to sort of take away a little bit from that whiskey revolution. They want whiskey lovers to branch out and try. I think this is very smart on their part, creating these new, unusual, collectible products. Even if you drank everything inside, that bottle is still absolutely a collectible. It's the kind of thing you're going to put on a shelf. It's also the kind of thing that real gin lovers are going to to talk about. They're going to compare. They're going to go out of their way to find your product and engage with your product because you've released something like this. And I just think that's brilliant. You want to create a sense of exclusiveness. That's very difficult when you're a larger company. You're sort of trying to balance, well, you distribute to 31 different countries or more. People are drinking your spirit all over the world. It's one of the top selling spirits in the world. How do you create a sense of exclusiveness when everybody knows that it's not? Everybody knows that you can go right down to the store and pick up Beefeater. And that's when you create these higher quality, unusual. This one in particular, they claim that they distill it in James Burroughs. That must be the name on the label. That's the original owner, the founder. James Burroughs' original copper still. So it's going to have a different quality because of that. And then because of the aging, it's going to be a little bit different there. It's going to have some of the oak, the vanilla, the caramelness to it. And it's going to be a little bit more mellowed out. All right. So thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. I hope you feel more informed. And I hope you drink something delicious today or tomorrow or whenever you feel like it's appropriate to drink. Probably not at work, definitely not when you're driving, and usually not in front of your grandma. Although if you have like a rad grandma who wants to drink with you, then do that. That sounds cool. I hope you have a good day. All right, thank you, and I hope you listen to my next podcast.